write down, I'd be interested, don't look at your neighbor, write down just yourself, don't look at your spouse, write down who would be your two or three best friends. Maybe you just put it on your phone, your tablet if you've got it. You can't write down your spouse's name, you can't write down your brother's name, you can't write your cousin's name. This has to be a friend. This is somebody who you could call at 2 a.m. if your car broke down, or if you needed to be bailed out of jail or something like that, okay? You could call this person at 2 in the morning. This is somebody that, if your marriage is going through struggles or you're having major conflict and you're like, I know we need to involve somebody, you could call this man or this woman. This would be somebody that if you got bad news about your health, about your finances, about your kids, you would be able to reach out to this man or to this woman. Now, you've written the name down, you're thinking of the name, it's on your phone. I'm not asking you to share it, but what I'm asking is, was that an easy exercise for you to write down or think of two to three names? Because if you are the average American, they say the average American has less than two close friends. And they said that 25% of Americans, when polled, said they didn't have, so 25%, one out of four, said they didn't have anybody to share their greatest joys or struggles with in their life. So even though we interact with, they tell us that we interact with between 500 and 2,500 people a year, the average American, depending on your job, if you're in school, if you're introverted or extroverted, basically between 500 and 2,500 people a year you interact with, yet the average person has less than two close friends, and 25% of Americans say, I have nobody. Men are even worse. They say, if you isolate the men, they say once a man gets over 30 years old, he has less than one close friend. Think about your dad for a moment. Does your dad have close male friends? I didn't say drinking buddies. I didn't say guys he likes to watch sports with. I didn't say people he likes to play sports with. Does your dad or did your dad have good friends? Someone that could challenge him, someone that could ask him hard questions, someone that could had, as Tim Keller said, had a hunting license, could get into his life and ask some hard questions about marriage and money and parenting and struggles and temptations. If you're like most people, your dad probably did not have close friends. Think about this for a moment. How much different would your life be, some of you, if your dad had some close friends? If your dad had a right? Just somebody who would have challenged him, somebody who would have seen the path he was heading down, and was able to say something to him 10 years before it imploded or exploded. This is the importance of friendship. And we're going to talk about today because here's the truth. The book of Proverbs deals with the friendship relationship more than it deals with the marriage relationship. It deals with the friendship relationship more than it deals with the parent-child or the boss-employee or any other relationship. Yet, let's be honest, the church, and I confess as part of the church, and I love the church, the church has done a terrible job teaching on friendship. If you want to learn about premarital counseling, if you want to learn about marriage, if you want to take a class on parenting, if you want to kind of understand work and faith and how that works, we do a decent job. But very rarely do you ever hear a sermon or a teaching on friendship. Yet this is what we all long for. Think about it. What is the best, one of the best watched shows of the early 90s? A show called Friends. Right, with that kind of theme song, I'll be there for you, you know, right? That the idea of friendship, and we loved it, and we loved it so much that it went for 10 seasons. Think about that. You know how few shows have ever gone for 10 seasons? And then that went off, and they interviewed one of the actors, and he said, well, you know, why do they like it so much? He said, it's a fantasy world. It's six people who live in a major U.S. city who are best friends, who do relationship and life and everything together. So when that show goes off the air, what's the next show that comes on that everyone watches? How I Met Your Mother. 9 seasons. Not easy for a show to go 9 seasons. What's it about? A bunch of single people hanging out in a city, doing life together. That show goes off the air. What comes on right after that? New Girl. Just finished the 6th season, planning on a 7th season. What's it about? Bunch of friends in a city, hanging out, doing life together. There's something about when we see these shows, they resonate with every generation. And we're like, we wish we had that. We wish we had something like that. But what we have today instead is Facebook friends. Now, I checked as of early this week, and now I got to be honest, I've confirmed a few new friendships, so it may be higher than this. But my Facebook friend count as of Monday or Tuesday was 2,000. 487 Facebook friends. Now, I hate to break it to me, okay? I hate to break it to myself. I don't think they're all my friends. I don't think they're really all my friends, especially because sometimes this happens to you guys. Somebody shows up on your feed and you're like, who is this person? And you click their name. You're like, no, we're friends. I never even went to that school. I don't even know that person. You know, we have no mutual friends. I have no idea how this person became my friend. We have all these friendships, but let's be honest, I'm not going to go to Costco and ask for a massive cake for all my Facebook friends. All my Facebook friends were not invited to my wedding. All my Facebook friends will not be at my funeral. If I have to move, they're not going to be grabbing the other end of the couch, right? So we have this huge kind of number of people that we would call friends, but we all know that friendship takes more than pressing a button with our thumb that says confirm or add friend. There's something more to friendship, but we have all of these friends, all of these people, but oftentimes, like I said before, the average American does not have many close friends. And so it's not surprising, it shouldn't be surprising to us, that when these parents, and that's what we're picking up on, the book of Proverbs, remember, is two parents speaking to their children, particularly their son, about what's most important. And isn't it interesting that right after they talk about the relationship with God, which we would agree that's the most important, that's why they say fear the Lord, the second relationship that they talk about is their relationship with their friends. This is so important, who your friends are and who you choose to associate with and walk life with, because last week we talked about how wisdom is a path, but you have to decide what are the people that I'm going to travel on, and different people are on different paths. And so let me give you kind of the big idea for this sermon, and then we're going to dive into the rest of, or most of the rest of chapter one this afternoon and evening. But here's the big idea. Show me your friends, and I'll show you the future. Show me your friends, and I'll show you your future. In other words, if I could actually get to see who you spend the majority of your time with, your close friends, your nearest and your dearest group, your clique, your posse, your gang, whatever you call them, your amigos, okay? If I could see who they are and I just could stop for a moment and really kind of know who they are and think about it, I would say I probably 80 to 90% could tell you where you're going to be in 5 years. I just have to look at their, you know, I've heard one guy say you're the average of your five friends, your five closest friends is who you are. So your friends determine the quality and the direction of your future. And so the Proverbs knows this. There's one verse that just does it really well in explaining this. It's Proverbs 13, verse 20. And I want to open up with this, and then we'll dive into the rest of chapter 1. Proverbs 13, verse 20 says this, whoever walks, that's language of a path, whoever walks with the wise becomes wise. In other words, wisdom is contagious. To some extent, wisdom is contagious. But the companion of fools will become foolish. It doesn't say that. It's not a direct parallel. Look what it says. But the companion of fools will suffer harm. I bring this up because some people will say, yeah, I hang out with foolish people. They believe differently. They act differently. But I don't believe what they believe, and I don't do what they do. And what the Proverbs is saying is, it's not about that. If you connect yourself to foolish people, on the path of foolish people is pain. Pain is coming your way, trial is coming your way, unnecessarily, if you connect yourself with foolish people. You need to see where they're headed and what the direction is. And so what they're saying, what the parents are saying, what the Bible's saying to us, is that one of the greatest decisions we can make is who are we going to connect our lives to? Who are going to be our closest friends, our nearest and dearest friends? Let's look at what is said in Proverbs chapter 1, verses 8 through 19. I'm going to read all of this, and we're going to walk through this together tonight. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. Again, parents talking to son. For they are a graceful garland for your head, and penance for your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive and whole. Like those who go down to the pit, we shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us. We will all have one purse. My son, do not, again, language of the path, walk in the way with them. Hold back your foot from their paths. For their feet run to evil. They make haste to shed blood. For in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird. But these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors. Okay, let's just set up the context again. There's two parents speaking to their son, giving advice on how to live life wisely. And the first thing that we see here is that wisdom starts at home. Very simple concept, but every topic that is discussed, whether it be sex, whether it be marriage, whether it be finances, whether it be how to use your tongue, whether it be understanding wealth and poverty, whether it be work ethic versus being a sluggard, all of these topics are given in the context of the home. And what's amazing, and this is so simple, but we live in a culture where more and more the average person is growing up without both parents in the home, or parents are not on the same page in parenting and philosophy and everything. Listen to this. The Proverbs assumes two parents who love each other, love their kids, and believe the same things. That's what it assumes. The safest way to make sure you're going to believe the same thing your spouse does is to marry another believer. Thankfully, my wife and I, though we do have some arguments, we don't argue about how to raise the kids because we have the same authority. We understand what the Bible says. We understand, we agree on the biggest and most important things, so it's very easy to teach our kids. We're not arguing, should we do devotions or should we not? Should our kids live this way or should we not? We have already agreed on the major things. This is what you see in the Proverbs. You see a mom and a dad, they're both talking, they're both teaching. Do you see that in verse 8 and 9? Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. Here's what we believe. We believe the home is the first mission field. We talk a lot about local missions, right? National missions, global missions. We think the first local mission is the little people who share your last name. The little people in my house, there's three of them, they have my last name. It would be a shame for me to invest and teach and disciple a bunch of other people, but forget about the people in my home. And so the home is the first mission field. This is what our kids' ministry believes. This is why we say our desire is to partner with parents to raise a generation in Christ. That's the vision and the mission of our kids' ministry. And so you have these two parents, and they're both speaking. And here's why this is important. So often, and I hear this again and again and again, that mothers especially get very frustrated when they feel like they're bearing all of the burden for the kids. I'm the only one teaching. I'm the only one worried about their education. I'm the only one that's really concerned about their behavior. You know, the husband, the father doesn't seem as concerned about who they're hanging out with. And what the Proverbs assumes and expects is a husband and a wife, a mother and a father, who are both invested, present, and involved in the life of their kids. I think today one of the greatest struggles for us is technology. They did a survey recently, I just saw this, where they interviewed parents and they interviewed kids, and they asked both, are you frustrated with your parents' use of technology? And they asked the parents, are you frustrated with your kids' use of technology? Guess what? The kids are more frustrated. The kids are more frustrated with how their parents are using technology to not pay attention, to avoid them. I actually believe that we're going to raise a generation, the first generation, that likes technology less than us. Because they're going to see how it's you know, basically controlling, and how so many of the parents are enslaved to it, to where we can't see how our kids are doing or what path they're on or who their friends are or what their struggles are if all we're concerned about is continuing to work from home, continuing to get on our social media, getting the kids down so we can finish whatever episode and series that we're in. This is a very dangerous path and pattern. And what the scriptures assume are parents that are active and that are present in the life of their kids. This is what we see with the father and with the mother in this passage. And verse 9, they know how to, when they're present, they know how to motivate their kids. One of the most important leadership principles you can learn, because leading yourself is difficult, leading people is difficult, you have to realize, how do I motivate people? How do you motivate yourself? How do you know how to motivate yourself? The gospel should be our main motivation, what Christ has done for us. Paul talks about the love of Christ controls us, the fear of God. There's different motivations that we can have. But here, the parents know how to motivate their kids. Here's what they say. Verse 9, for wisdom, that's what they're talking about, wisdom, teaching, instruction. For they are a graceland garland for your head and pennants for your neck. Not necessarily what we would maybe say to our kids, because we didn't understand the culture and the context. Here's what they're saying, that wisdom, teaching, good understanding, and living a wise life is like, first, a garland. That's a victory wreath on your head. In other words, what wisdom brings is winning. What wisdom delivers is victory. And then secondly, they talk about penance, jewelry. Think about this. Think about motivating men and women and saying, if you want to understand true victory and true beauty, if you want to know what it really means to win in life, if you want to use that phrase, or to have a victory, if you want to know what it really means to be a beautiful person, you've got to be wise. If you sow that into the heart of children at a young age, here's what victory is. Here's what beauty is. They begin to understand things, and they begin to be motivated to live a godly and a Christian, wise life. So here's what we see. We see the parents are speaking into them. They're speaking into their kids' lives. And the first thing, just a reminder, the first thing they're talking to their kids about is their friends. You know, this is such an important topic because, in some of you, you know this. You know that your parents, very early on, they were concerned about who your friends were. Some of you, this is my story. Some of you, your parents moved you out of school districts and said, well, you're not going to be in that school district anymore as you go in elementary school or middle school or high school. I'm going to move you over to here because I'm concerned about your friends. This is not even a Christian principle. This is just a principle for Christians or non-Christians, is the reality that your friends direct and influence the quality of your life and your future. And so you see parents and they say, okay, hold on, we got to move out of this neighborhood. Sometimes they say, we got to move out of this city. We got to get you out of this apartment complex. Whatever it was, I've seen this so many times over the years, parents making major decisions to try to get their kids in a healthy environment where they can be influenced. This is why some of you didn't understand it growing up and you were like, man, I don't understand why I can't hang out at Johnny's house. His parents are the coolest. They let us do whatever we want. Exactly. You know, some of you ladies, you were like, I don't understand why I can't date this guy. I mean, he's a couple years older than me, and he looks so cute, and he has his own car and can take me anywhere. And exactly. That's why you cannot be friends with him, because he has his own car and can take you anywhere. So this is why we have to understand that we've got to speak to our kids about their friends. This isn't helicopter parents, but this is caring. This is investing in our kids. But what you have to understand first is that we, as parents, those of us who are parents, and many of you will be parents one day, that parents are not to be their kids' friends. That, you know, look, I mean, I love my kids. I talk about them a lot. I got three kids. They are not my friends. I'm not friends with my kids. I love them. But what my kids do not need is another friend. They've got a lot of friends. They're excited about them. They've got them in the kids' ministry. They've got them at the YMCA. They've got them at school. They have them in our neighborhood. They have lots of friends. What they don't have is lots of people that are going to give them guidance, discipline them, be an authority in their life, give them direction, let them give them advice and wisdom and counsel. And so what you see here is parents embracing their role as parents, not peers, and investing in their kids and talking to their kids about their friends. And here's why friends are so good and so dangerous. Here's what happens, and this has happened with all of you, with all of your friends. This is what happens. You're accepted by a group of peers. You've got your group, your amigos, your clique, your gang, whatever, your tribe. And you know what happens is you're accepted. And so you're accepted by them and you hang out with them. And so this is a natural, you didn't even notice it happening, but you drop your guard when you're around your friends. You just relax. You talk about whatever's on your heart. They talk about it. It's a safe place, and so you're listening. So therefore, it's in the context of friends. This is what makes it so good and so dangerous. It's in the context of friendship that you're greatly influenced. And all of a sudden, you begin to love the things your friends love. And you begin to talk like your friends, and you begin to do the things that your friends are doing. And that's a great thing if you're surrounding yourself with wise people, but it's a dangerous thing if you're surrounding yourself with foolish people. And so this is what the Proverbs continues to talk about. Here's the principle, another principle out of this, is that our life is only as good as our relationships. It's another way to say that our friends determine our future. Our life is only as good as our relationships. You know this because even though you were making a lot of money or you were doing good in school or you had all the new gadgets and you had the home or the car or whatever, if the relationships around you are imploding, your marriage, your friends, your work relationships, none of that other stuff matters. I actually knew a guy personally who left a 7-figure job because he couldn't stand the relationships at work. He left a $1 million job because the relationships at work were so terrible. On the other hand, if your relationships in life are good, you can handle almost anything. Financial crisis, health crisis. You realize, oh, thank goodness we have our relationships. I have my friends. I have people who care about me. The fool, who we talked about last week, remember, there's the wise and the fool. The fool, whenever you read the book of Proverbs, you see the fool walking down the path of foolishness, and it says always this, watch this as you read Proverbs in the future, he's either with other foolish people, so he's either with the wrong people, or he's by himself. Let me ask you, how many things have you done sinfully or foolishly because you were either by yourself or with the wrong people? How many times, because you were isolated, it was spring break and no one else was home, or it was the summer break and you didn't know anybody, or you were somewhere else and no one that knew you was there, and you were alone, or it was late at night, and you probably did something foolish. This is why I know a lot of Christians who, during their single years, they say, I actually do not want to live by myself. We're not saying it's a sin to live by yourself, but a lot of Christians will say, if I live by myself, I'm just afraid. With no accountability and no one around me, I don't know what I would watch. I don't know who I would invite over. I don't know what I would be doing late at night. I need a roommate. Even though it's more frustrating at times, I actually need somebody else in my life. Or you all know that sometimes you do the most foolish things when you're in a group of foolish people. For those of you who smoked your first cigarette, if you've ever done that, I'm guessing it wasn't alone. If you ever stole something, I'm guessing you didn't do it by yourself. If you ever cheated somewhere, I bet it wasn't just by yourself. We tend to do some of the most foolish things either in isolation or with the wrong people. And the Proverbs knows all this and said, hold on. Let's get on the right path with the right people. And so the parents warn of the wrong type of people. But they do so first by talking about what is friendship. Let's just take a moment and talk about what friendship is, because this is important. I haven't necessarily defined it. What is friendship? Because the desire for it shows up very early in life. My kids are always talking about their friends. They're excited about going to the kids' ministry because of their friends. They're excited about going to the Y because of their friends. They're excited about going to school because of their friends. But what is friendship? I think C.S. Lewis says it best. He defines it by, he says, you have to compare it to romantic love. He says, in romantic love, when a man loves a woman, a woman loves a man, they say what happens in that relationship is it's a face-to-face relationship. And you kind of are infatuated with the other person, and you talk a lot about your relationship, and you talk a lot about the other person. That's kind of a face-to-face, that's a romantically loving relationship. But friendship, they said, C.S. Lewis says, instead of being face-to-face, friendship is shoulder-to-shoulder. He said very rarely do friends talk about their friendship. But it arises out of a common love. Here's what, I love this definition. Here's what C.S. Lewis says. Friendship is born at the moment when one man says to another, what, you two? I thought I was the only one. That you begin to have something in common with another man, or you begin to have something in common with another woman, and all of a sudden, that just creates a shoulder-to-shoulder relationship. This is incredibly important. So this is why the parents warn of foolish relationships. This is the second point. Wisdom warns of bad friendships or foolish friendships. Proverbs 1, verses 10 through 14. Here you have it. My son, again, addressed personally. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive and whole, like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us. We will all have one purse. What the parents do is, you can see they even kind of put language into these friends in these relationships, kind of showing them what they're really doing. But they're very honest about how a person could be attracted to hang out with the wrong group. Do you see what they say in verse 10? My son, if sinners entice you. What they're saying is, at some point in everyone's life, sometimes it's when you change schools, sometimes when it's you start a new job, sometimes when you move into a new neighborhood, usually at kind of a transition point in your life, you're going to be looking for a new group of friends. And what they say is that every time, and this happens a lot in college, you kind of move in, you get into your dorm, and you've got to kind of decide, who am I going to be friends with? And what he's saying here, and I love how honest the Bible is, they're saying there's something that's going to be attractive and enticing about what foolish people do. I can remember this. Again, I've told you guys my story before. I didn't become a Christian until the end of my sophomore year of high school. But I can remember hanging out with basically the wrong crowd, with the people here that, you know, is talked about not hanging out with. And I remember the excitement of it. I remember talking about doing, about how we were going to spend our weekends. And I knew it was wrong, but there was just something exciting about it. I know we would talk about, we're going to sneak out of this house, and you're going to sneak out of this house, and we're going to meet up here, and then our parents find out and we all get in trouble, you know. But I mean, it was enticing in the moment. You're like, oh, we're going to do this, and it's so exciting, even though I knew it was wrong. And what the Proverbs is saying, when you're young, you have a desire for friendship, you have a desire to experience the world, you're going to be enticed to hang out and spend time with the wrong people. And here's the principle here. It's always easier to stay out of temptation than to get out of temptation. And so what they're saying is if you begin to hang out with the wrong type of people, you begin to, sometimes you get into things that you realize, I wish I would have never known what it's like to get drunk. But what I did was I hung out with the wrong people and we drank too much and I liked it. Uh-oh. And so now I need to learn not how to just stay away from something. That's hard enough. Now I need to learn how to get out of something. I've experienced something I shouldn't have. I've done something I shouldn't have. I've seen something I shouldn't have. And now I've experienced it. I'm in it. It's more difficult to get out of it once you're in it. This is the danger of hanging out with the wrong type of people. All of a sudden, you find yourself in the wrong places, dressing the wrong way, having the wrong conversations, meeting up with the wrong boys or the wrong girls, with substances that probably shouldn't be there. And all of a sudden, you have to decide, what am I going to do? And it's harder when you're in the temptation already to get out of it than to stay out of it. And what the parents are trying to warn at a young age is, stay away from that temptation. Next, they promise the short-term benefits of sin. Do you see this in verse 13? We shall all find precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder. In this situation, it's money. It could be sex. It could be just pleasure. It could be some type of high. They promise the short-term benefits of something without the long-term consequences. They tell you the next step in the path, but they don't show you the end of the path. And so the next step in the path looks, oh, innocent and fun, but then you don't realize where this path is leading if I do this again and again and again. Finally, they promise camaraderie. They promise a sense of belonging. Look at verse 14. Throw in your lot among us, and we will all have one purse. In other words, you'll be part of us. And again, I've said this a couple times, but we have a deep desire to belong. We have a deep desire to say, this is my tribe, these are my friends, this is my group. They think like me, they love the things I love, they accept me. I've got something to do on Friday or Saturday or the weekend. And one of the principles here is that we are all susceptible to peer pressure. We are all susceptible to peer pressure. And this is what they're saying. The parents are saying, if you get around these type of people, don't think that you're strong enough. Don't think that you're cool enough, you're strong enough, you've seen enough, you know enough. What they're saying is if you begin to put yourself around the wrong type of people, it will begin to have a negative influence on yourself. But positively, this principle works both ways. If you will connect yourself to some strong Christians, to some godly and wise people, it will begin to deeply influence and affect your life. I know for myself, when I became a Christian, I was, 10th grade, end of my 10th grade year, was living a very ungodly life. God radically changes my life, saves me, changes me. I'm born again. I got these new desires. And what I needed more than anything else was some new friends. I loved my other friends. In fact, I saw some of them come to faith in Christ, and I'm grateful for them. And I have some of these relationships even today with some of my high school buddies who don't know Christ. But what I needed when I came to faith in Christ was something else to do and somewhere else to be and another group to be with on Fridays or Saturdays. I needed another group. I needed another lunch table to kind of encourage me. I just needed several different things. For me, we had a high school Bible study that was at this family's house from our school, and I don't think I realized how much God used that study in my life for the next 2 years, just to give me 10 or 12 friends to walk through life with, to walk through struggles with, to pray with, to share trials and temptations with. Was a very meaningful time in my life. So the father warns of the path of the foolish friend. Verse 15, my son, do not walk in the path with them. Hold back your foot from their paths, for their feet run to evil. If you drop down to verse 19, such are the ways of everyone who's greedy. Six different times it references their feet, the path, or a way. What you see throughout the book of Proverbs is this focusing on the feet. And that sounds weird, but they'll say this all the time. When it comes to the friends, it'll go, yeah, I know they made a lot of money. I know they're really cool right now. Watch their feet. Because where they're walking and where they're headed is death and destruction. The same thing happens in chapter 5. We won't get there this series, but next time we get into Proverbs, we'll probably get to chapter 5. You have a situation where the adulterous woman shows up. And I love how honest the father is. He's like, look, she's very good looking. He talks about her lips. He says her lips will drip honey. She'll seem seductive and sweet. And then he says this, watch her feet. Doesn't matter how beautiful she is, look at her feet, because where her feet are headed is death and destruction. This is the same principle you learn anytime you play a sport, right? No one can fake you out if you focus on their feet. They can shimmy one way or shimmy the other way, but if you're watching their feet, whether it's basketball or football or soccer, you're going to know where they're going because their feet don't lie. In the same way, the parents are saying, there are some foolish friends. The way you know who your friends are is you got to look at their feet. Where is the direction of their life? Because if you connect yourself to them, that will be your direction as well. Let me ask you this question. It sounds direct. It doesn't sound very Christian, but I promise you that it is. Who do you need to no longer be friends with? Who would you say, it doesn't mean you don't pray for them, it doesn't mean you don't love them, it doesn't mean you don't want to share the gospel with them, but what it means is you know, and maybe someone's coming to your mind as I've talked about foolish friends, you know when I'm with this person, I drink too much. When I'm with this person, I say too much, I gossip too much. When I'm with this person, I lower my standards and the way I talk changes. When I'm with this person, I'm different. When I'm with this person, I'm different and not in a good way, that should be a warning that this should not be a person that should be your nearest and your dearest friend because they're influencing you to be more like them. You're not having the influence on them for Christ that you wish you were. Next, it doesn't just tell us who to not walk with, it tells us who to walk with. Wisdom tells us who to walk with, how to have wise friends. And to do this, I'm actually going to pick up the main verses throughout the rest of the Proverbs. So the way Proverbs works is the first 9 chapters is kind of a conversation between a father and a son. And then chapters 10 through 30 are a bunch of wise sayings about a bunch of different things. And so what I'm doing is I'm going to pick up all of the wise sayings, not all of them, but many of them, and organize them. What are the wise sayings about what it means to be a friend? What does it mean to be a friend, a good friend, according to the Bible, according to wisdom literature? Again, I told you, Proverbs talks about friendship more than any other relationship. So what I've done is, with the help of Tim Keller, who wrote a little study on this, as well as 2 other little books I read on friendship this week, kind of arose out of this 6 different principles of true friends. And when you think about these, maybe you just want to grab these and say, I don't want to focus on anyone else. I want to focus on myself becoming, by the grace of God, a better friend to other people. Let's look at each one of these. First, true friends are chosen. You get to, this is so simple, but sometimes simple things change our lives. You get to choose your friends. You did not get to choose your gender. You didn't get to choose your ethnicity. You didn't get to choose your parents. You didn't get to choose where you were born. You didn't get to choose how tall you'd be. You didn't get to choose all of the skills and the gifts that you would have or wouldn't have. But you get to choose your friends. We see this with Jesus. Jesus spends a lot of time praying in Mark chapter 3, getting ready to choose his friends. Jesus never got married. Jesus never had children, but he had 12 very good friends. And of those friends, he had 3 that were even closer. Peter, John, and James. And so what we see here is that we are called, you can even look at the life of Jesus, we are to be friendly toward all, but friends with a few. I think that's a good way to say it. We are to be friendly toward all. Think about Jesus. Jesus loved the world. Jesus was friendly with everyone he met. Healing, teaching, preaching, helping, but he was deep friends with a few. And we all know this because you've seen this in your own life. You've seen that you don't have the capacity to be friends with everybody. Some of your friendships are seasonal. If you open up your high school yearbook and you see someone right in there, never change, you're the best, we'll be together forever, and you're like, who is this person? You know, this is 12 years ago, but they said they were my best friend, I don't even know who they are. Or just pull out your wedding pictures, those of you who are married. Once it's more than 5 or 6 years of being married, you look at your wedding pictures, you realize, those were my best friends, most of them, that 1 year of my life before I got married. But life's changed, and I've moved, and they've moved. And so part of it is seasonal. We only have so much capacity. Sociologists tell us that 40% of our relational energy goes to 5 people. So, you know, you have a wife and kids, a husband and kids. You've got a roommate. I mean, you only have so much relational energy. Now, certain extroverts have more, but the idea here is that we have to choose our friends. Here's the proverb, Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. A friend loves at all times, a brother is born for adversity. He's comparing friendship and brotherhood. What's the difference? You get to choose your friends. You don't get to choose your siblings. You cannot be friends with everybody, so you have to begin to choose, given season of my life, given different things, who could I really invest in? Who could I really deeply develop a friendship with? Secondly, true friends are constant. We see this in Proverbs 18:24. A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Now, you have to understand, hearing this in the first century, or even before that, in a Jewish culture where family was elevated to the highest level. I mean, family was at the core of everything. And to say to that culture and that society, to say there's actually a friendship that could be more significant than a sibling was a big statement. And what's the difference here? We see it in verse 17, Proverbs 17, 17. A friend loves at all times. The difference here is that Proverbs 19, 7 says this, wealth brings many new friends, but a poor man is deserted by his friend. So they're saying there's certain friendships that they were based on, you thought they were friends, but it was more socioeconomic. You guys connected, you both were able to be at that country club or that private club, or you both had a lot of excess money and you could do these things together, but it really wasn't based on a deep friendship. The Puritans called friends that weren't constant, they called them swallow friends. Swallows were birds that left in winter. They were friends that they said, okay, yeah, you get cancer, sorry, we're not really friends anymore. Your socioeconomic status changes, your health changes, your finances changes, your kids get crazy. True friends stay through that. I love this quote by Martin Luther. Martin Luther, he said this. He said that a true friend walks in when everybody else is walking out. That a true friend is constant no matter what. A great example of this from history would be Billy Graham. Billy Graham, many of you may not know this, but was a famous evangelist, spoke all over the world, and he ended up being friends with many of the presidents. And there was this interesting book written about Billy Graham and his friendship with the presidents, and they asked the presidents, why were you friends with Billy Graham? And they said, almost all of them said, we felt like Billy Graham was the only friend who didn't want something from us. And no matter what policy we put in place, no matter, whether we were going to be elected that year, whether it was a season of trial in the media or whatever, Billy Graham was a constant friend. He's a great example of just being constant. Now, I think one of the hard things about being a constant friend is there are hard times, and we do sin against one another. And a good friendship is a friendship that's, we're going to see this in a second, but it's honest, and it's a friendship that can forgive one another. It's a friendship that can confront one another. Which leads me to my third point. True friends are candid. Yes, these all start with C. Make it easy for you guys, okay? So they're chosen, they're constant, and they're candid. In other words, let me give you a verse here. Proverbs 27, 6. Again, these are all proverbs about friendship. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. So there's some people who will say things to you, they'll be nice to you, they'll be gentle with you, but they don't really love you, they don't really care about you. They flatter you. But there are friends who they're able to say, a true friend, if he or she is able to say hard things to you. The opposite of this, sadly, is gossip. And this is something that I want to work on in my own life too, that if you're talking to somebody about somebody else, and you're like, have you seen their marriage? Yeah, it looks like they're going through a rough time. It looks like he needs to better communicate. It looks like she needs to better. If you're telling that to somebody else, you need to go, hold on a second. I think I need to stop, and I need to talk to that person. And I need to not talk about them. I need to talk to them, because if I'm really their friend, I care if their marriage is falling apart. Or if you watch somebody, you're like, dude, have you seen how she spends money? Doing that, you're going to be in debt soon. It's like, well, hold on a second. What if you talk to her? And there's nothing more powerful in a relationship that where we can have relationships where we can say hard things in loving ways to one another. I think that's one of the main marks of a true friendship, is that you're able to say hard things. Now, you have to make the relational deposits before you can make the relational withdrawals. But this is something that I have to do, just given the nature of my roles and responsibilities. I probably have these conversations almost every week. And this last week, I had one, and it went really well. They don't always do, but I had a conversation with somebody, and I just said, hey, I want to ask you about this, and it was a sin issue, and I brought it up, and this person, I just loved their response. They said, thanks so much for bringing this up. Yeah, this is something I want to talk to you about. I want to open up and tell you about it. And it was, our relationship was deeper afterwards. This person thanked me for it. I got more clarity, and it actually brought us closer together because I was willing to confront and ask some questions. Some of you, as you get close to your friends, you're going to see some things in their marriages and their finances and all of these areas, and their parenting, and it's very difficult, I know. It's very difficult to speak into somebody else's parenting, I know. But we need to do it sometimes. We need to say some things. We need, because we love and because we care, we need to be candid. On the other end of that, we need to be careful. So that's why it's two ends of it. Candid but careful. Here's the principle. Connect before you correct. Right? This is what's most helpful. In other words, if you've got to say something hard, it would be helpful to say, hey, I love you. I care about you. Maybe it's in the context of a meal. Maybe, you know, you can affirm in a lot of ways, but you're honest and you're sharing with them what needs to change, what you see. Or, you know, one of my favorite phrases, I learned this from a guy who discipled me, to really soften a situation is just to use this phrase, help me understand. It's very hopeful. Can you help me understand why you would talk to your wife that way? Can you just help me understand that? Because what is it saying? It's saying, I want to understand. I'm not trying to accuse you. I just help me understand how you think about your work balance and life balance. Can you just help me? How do you think about that? And it really should be hopeful, right? All confrontation and all kind of candid conversation should have the feel of, I believe by the grace of God, you're better than this. You don't need to do that. There's just a warmth in it. The warning in Proverbs is of the person who doesn't know how to be careful. Here's two examples. Whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice. So blessing would be a good thing, right? Whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice, rising early in the morning, will be counted as cursing. Why? Because that person is still sleeping. Okay, I have a situation right now. My kids get up sometime between 6 and 7, closer to 6. And they love to come down and just, my son will often come down the steps shooting at me. Just air guns, just his fingers. And just, you know, telling me he's Spider-Man and if I want to play ninja. And I'm like, no, not right now. You know, it's so cute, but not at 6 in the morning. You know, not right now, it's not. Because even though it's the cutest thing ever, it's not the right time. I'm going to share this with him later. This on friendship, no. Proverbs 25, verse 20. Whoever sings songs, that would be happy songs, to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soda. It would not be wise to sing happy songs when someone's going through hard times. What being careful means is I can't be sad if you're happy and I can't be happy if you're sad. I'm emotionally sensitive and I'm emotionally connected and I'm self-aware enough that I know how you're doing and I want to be able to speak to that situation. I want to be able to ask questions and I want to be there. The opposite of this, or one of the extremes of this that the Proverbs talks about, is smothering. Let me give you a verse. Proverbs 25, 17. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house, or it could be friend's house. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house, lest he have his fill of you and hate you. Let me explain smothering for a second. This is an important distinction. There's only one relationship that is about oneness. Marriage. Marriage is one bank account, one bed, one last name, you know, one house, one. Every other relationship is about two. And what happens in smothering is when a friend acts like he's married to you or a friend acts like she's married to you and she begins to treat your house like it's her house and your car like it's her car and your money like it's her money. And it begins to be smothering. It begins to be, it's not saying that we shouldn't be generous, it's not saying we shouldn't be hospitable, but there comes a point where the person is not aware and they don't realize, I'm here all the time. I'm not giving you the space that you would need. You have your own house, family, wife, life. And I need to have a healthy, deep friendship with you, but I don't want to smother you. That can be honestly a candid and careful conversation that could be had at one point. Am I smothering? Or you are smothering. That could be a conversation. Fifthly, true friends give counsel. True friends give counsel. Proverbs 27:9. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. In other words, this very much lines up with being careful and candid, but true friends speak into one another's lives, even when it's not confronting sin or ever, just they give advice, they give counsel. They speak into marriages and relationships and finances and all the categories of our lives. They have a hall pass. They have a hunting license to come in and to speak in these areas. Years ago, I heard Paul Tripp. He's a well-known counselor, has counseled hundreds, maybe thousands of couples and singles. And I'll never forget him talking to a group of us saying, you know, most situations that come to my desk, by the time they have to sit in my office, they're so complex and complicated and convoluted. It's been years and years and years of marriage or abuse or parenting or money or whatever. And he said, this is what hit me. He said, But in almost every one of those situations, if very early on they would have just involved a few close friends, it could have been taken care of. But time and secrecy and don't say it, and he doesn't need to know and she doesn't need to know, and what would they think, and I don't know if we can really be honest. And you do that for 5 or 10 or 15 years, and you've got a really complex situation. You've got a lot of history. And so let me encourage you, if you're going through something, begin to find, maybe you haven't already, find a friend who you can open up and say, hey, this is what's hard in my life. This is what I'm struggling with. This is a sin. This is a struggle in my life, in my marriage, in my relationships, in my time alone. And we need friends who will speak into our lives. I love what Gordon MacDonald says. He says this, there's a certain niceness to a friendship where I can be, as they say, I can be myself. But what I really need are friendships in which I will be encouraged to be better than myself. Isn't that awesome? That's the kind of friendships I desire. Finally, true friends need to live in close proximity. True friends need to live in close proximity. Look at Proverbs 27:10. Better is a neighbor who's near than a brother who's far away. I'm always concerned about the person who all of their best friends are from college. And all of their best friends are from high school. And they all live in different states. And they all have conversations on phone. And they all kind of travel to see each other occasionally. But they don't have any close friends here. I had a pastor tell me that he had done a study in most of the mega church and the giga church is churches over 10,000, most of the mega church and the giga church pastors that had fallen into some type of sin in the last 5 years, he said every one of them had friends who lived in different cities as their closest friends. So they saw them when they spoke at big events, they saw them at networking opportunities, but they didn't have anyone close in their life. And this pastor, he had just made a decision. He said, that's it, I'm going to go live in a neighborhood with a couple of my close friends from my church, because what I need more than anybody else is just people who see my life. So when you call and you're complaining about your marriage, someone can go, oh, hold on a second, no. I saw you guys at community group, and I saw how you talked to him, or I saw how you talked to her, and I don't think you're giving me the whole story. Or someone can say, hey, do you think it's wise for me to buy this? Well, if I live in Idaho and I don't know what your life looks like, yeah, go ahead. But if I see your whole life, didn't you just buy this? And didn't you just buy this? And what about this? And you see how this is important to have proximity, to be in each other's lives? This is one of the reasons we so encourage community groups and DNA groups. It's not, believe me, it's not that we're trying to have some large number of people in those groups. We've already got so many people. It's awesome. But we're not concerned about just growing that number. We're concerned about more people being in your life that know you. That people that love you, love Jesus, love the Bible. We say this all the time. When something terrible happens in your life, and it will eventually, you're going to need two things. People who know the Bible and people who love you. And if you can make some decisions today to get connected more deeply here at Two Cities, we think this is one of the places that'd be really helpful, where you can get more connected to these types of friends. Finally, how do I become a better friend? How do I become a better friend? Here's what people say. Let's just be honest. Let's have a real conversation as we kind of close this. Here's the reasons people say they don't have more friends, or they don't have better friends. Number one reason they say mobility. Oh yeah, we just all travel so much, and everybody's moving, and everybody's leaving, and people only stay here for 2 or 3 years. That's one reason. It's fair. Another reason is that we have no margin. So mobility and margin, okay? No margin. I'm too busy. But let's be honest. The main reason we don't have more friends or deeper friendships is we're not very good friends. We wish, if you'd be honest with yourself about those characteristics we talked about, how candid are we? How much counsel do we give? How careful are we? How constant are we in trial and temptation? This is why we need Jesus Christ. Listen, Jesus comes into the world and he says, I am a friend of sinners and tax collectors. And in John 15, he says this, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has none than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends. This is so powerful. Jesus comes into the world and defines friendship and says, I'm going to be the example of it. I'm going to be so constant, I'm going to lay my life down. And then when he rises from the dead and he gives the great commission in Matthew 28, what does he end with? I will be with you always. What is that saying? I will be constant. I will be committed to the end. Who is more honest about our struggles and our sins and our temptations than Jesus Christ, who speaks directly to us? Who is more careful and humble and winsome than Jesus Christ? Jesus Christ is the great example of friendship. He does two things. He gives us an example and a motivation to be a friend. We can look at his example, and he gives us the power to forgive people when they're not as good of friends as we would love them to be. Did Jesus know about friends, you know, betraying him? Yes. Judas betrayed him. Did he know about friends not being there when he really needed them to be there? Yes. All of them, basically. And so you have Jesus, who was the perfect friend and sinned against and forsaken by his friends, yet faithful to the end, forgives their sins, dies on the cross, raises from the dead, and teaches us how to have friendship with God and friendship with one another. So as the band comes up and as the prayer team heads to the back, I want to challenge us with just three specific things as we close. The first is, do you understand what it really means to be friends with God? That this is what Jesus Christ has done. Jesus Christ, in his life and his death and his resurrection, gave us the ability to have a friendly and open relationship with God. This is what the cross of Christ was about. I remember when I became a Christian, one of the most helpful things someone said to me is, Christianity is not about a religion, it's about a relationship. And the way that relationship and friendship is restored is by what Jesus Christ has done. Secondly, I would just ask you and challenge you, what do you have to do to begin to make friendships a priority in your life? Do you need to just open up your home more? Do you need to create more margin? Do you need to get connected to a DNA group or community group or something here? And then finally, what area would you like to see God grow you in the most when it comes to friendship? Because here's the truth. Every baptism I've ever done, every story that I've ever done when it comes to baptism has to do with somebody walking on a foolish path, and somewhere along the line, their family or a close friend was candid with them, helped brought counsel to them, helped care for them in a time of need. And every testimony involves the work that Jesus Christ did in their life and a friend who told them about that. And that's what we want. We want us to be better friends so that we can more help each other grow and be discipled, and we can reach more people for Christ. Let's pray for that.